You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good morning, everybody. Looking around this room, I can say that I see a lot of familiar faces, including those of you who are helping us never to miss a chance to talk about India. Obviously, India is an extraordinarily important and positive factor in the prospects for a peaceful 21st century. It is increasingly a very important partner of the United States, and we're going to be hearing during the course of this program the views and the interaction with you on the part of three very important experts. Our guest of honor is an Indian statesman who has played a very important role in Indian foreign policy for quite some time, Shivshankar Menon. We are launching a book today that has been just published by the Brookings Institution Press. It reflects on his four decades as a diplomat, and also it draws lessons from his career, particularly on very important and inflection point choices that the Indian government made over the course of his career, and I might add, with plenty of input of his advice and also implemented through his diplomatic skills. It's an extraordinary career. He has been, of course, the Foreign Secretary, the National Security Advisor to the Prime Minister, twice Ambassador to China, High Commissioner to Sri Lanka and Pakistan, and a Brookings connection. He, back in the 90s, was the Indian ambassador in Israel, where he got to know the American ambassador at that time, Martin Indyk. Shankar is now a distinguished fellow here at the Brookings Institution. He's based in Brookings, India, in New Delhi. We are delighted, Mohini, that you are here with quite a bit of your family, not all of it. Your son-in-law, Neil, Abhay, and Sarah, and I'm just sorry that you didn't bring the grandkids, because we're always looking for ways to have a little more generational diversity in our constituency and our audiences. Just a word about Nick Burns, who is well known to all of you. He's now at the Kennedy School at Harvard. As you all know, I'm sure, was the Undersecretary of State for Policy for a number of years. He has been deeply involved in the increasing engagement between the United States and India, and especially with regard to the completion and the success of the U.S.-India nuclear agreement. He is also a dear friend and a colleague of mine when I was in the government myself. Tanvi Madan is the director of our India project, and she will serve not just as a moderator, but also a very fine expert in her own right. So, Tanvi, over to you.
Thank you, Strobe, and thank you all for being here. Just a couple of matters of housekeeping and a couple of words on the book before I turn it over to the author, who I know you're all here to listen to. Please put your phones on silent. And there's just in terms of books will be available after the event outside, and Ambassador Menon has kindly agreed to sign some of those books for a little bit outside as well. For those of you who will be watching on video, which will be available on our website shortly after the event, or listening to the audio, and especially those who will be looking at this from abroad, The book is already available in the UK. It will be available in India towards the end of November, with a book launch there in New Delhi on December 2nd. In terms of the book itself, there's been increasing interest recently in Indian foreign policy, past, present, and future, both in India as well as here. And there's been a lot of scholarship recently that's been coming out, particularly on the past, and particularly thanks to the opening up of some of the archives and the personal papers of various practitioners, both bureaucrats and politicians. And while the scholarship is just coming out, is really, it's worth reading. It's available now much more widely. This practitioner's perspective is truly invaluable. And this book in particular, I would say, as a student of foreign policy, it's essential reading for anybody who wants to understand not just some of the past of these cases, but I would say also for anybody who wants to understand what kind of power India will be and what kind of role it will play on the world stage in the future. And with that, I'll turn to the author, Ambassador Menon.
Thank you, Tandi. And thank you, Strobe, for those very kind words of introduction. As you can see, he's a friend. Thank you, Tanvi, also. And thanks, Nick, for being here, because if it weren't for you three, actually, this book wouldn't exist. I suppose the first thing an author has to do is to explain why he wrote the book. Why did I think I should put this out in the public and inflict this on you? Last spring, thanks to Nick, I was running a study group on Indian foreign policy at Harvard, and we were looking at different cases of how India reacted to events. And when we came to 2611, to the Mumbai attacks, I'd speak for 40 minutes, and then for the rest of the 2 hours, we'd discuss it and see what the options were, what the choices were. I made my 40 minutes, and the first person to speak after that stood up and said, "My father was killed in 2611, and I don't see how you couldn't why you didn't attack Pakistan immediately after that." And that started a firestorm. In this room, 60 people, young, from Mongolia to Argentina and various points in between. And it went on, 2 hours, 2.5 hours, 2 hours, 45 minutes. I had to say, "Please, let's go home, clear the room." Because this is... But at the end of it, I thought, this is worth putting down. Just the considerations, the fact that so many people had brought so many ideas to the table about how to think about this problem. And so that's really where the book started. And what the book looks at is five cases. I mean, one is the Border Peace and Tranquility Agreement with China, which was in 1993, which was really the first agreement related to the border, to the boundary between India and the People's Republic of China. And it was within 30 years of the war over that boundary, and represented quite a significant choice for both countries. The second is something that Nick was intimately involved in, was the 123 agreement and the civil nuclear initiative between India and the US, which transformed the relationship, tore down the walls between the two countries, and in a sense created this huge sense of ambition on both sides. Ever since then, you're always being asked, what's the next big civil nuclear agreement equivalent that we can do between India and the US? The third was, as I said, 2611, how India chose to react. The fourth was Sri Lanka, the last 6 months of the LTTE in 2008-9, and how India, the international community, reacted to what was happening to really a brutal civil war which had lasted 26 years. And lastly, no first use. I mean, why does India have nuclear weapons, say she has nuclear weapons, and then say she won't use them? I mean, this is counterintuitive. So that's really what the book... I shouldn't tell you what the book actually says, because I ultimately want you to buy this book and read it. But it also then goes on to say at the end, there's a chapter where I think about what this means about India as a great power and what kind of power India could be, should be. But that's, of course, just my opinion, and I think it would be interesting to hear what you think about it. All in all, it's not a very big book. This is when I'm plugging the book. It's readable. It's a decent size. But it is, as Tanvi said, a practitioner's book. It doesn't try to develop a theory or to contribute to theory in any way, but what it does try and do is to lay out the facts and the kinds of considerations that went into these choices, all of which ultimately had fairly significant effect on certainly India's foreign policy and how India relates with the rest of the world. So I hope you enjoy the book. Well, first I hope you read it, then I hope you enjoy it. But maybe I should stop there and leave it to
Ambassador Burns.
Well, that was far too short. We need more from Shankar in this session. But Tanvi, thank you. And I just want to thank Strobe and Martin and Brookings for this gathering. I just have three things to say. One is to praise Shankar. Two is to say a word about the U.S.-India relationship. And three is to look ahead a little bit, and I think that's where we'll probably be going under Tanvi's leadership today, as to what a next U.S. administration should do with the Indian government. A word about Shankar. A lot of us in this room have been practicing diplomats. I see a lot of former colleagues in this room. And it's rare when you work with someone intensively that you are able to develop across cultural and national boundaries a relationship of affinity and a relationship of trust. But I think I developed that relationship with Shankar, and I'm here to praise him. An exceptional diplomat. And Strobe just listed some of the highlights of this extraordinary career. Probably the most singularly impressive career of anybody I know in global politics, in terms of what he's had to deal with, the important, the difficult, the sheer degree of difficulty of what he had to do. Think of Pakistan, China, and then he had to deal with the Americans. He survived it all. but we developed a friendship and a relationship of trust that is very important to me. We did not know when we negotiated the civil nuclear agreement together, and we met all over the world, in Asia, in the Middle East, in Europe, in South Asia, in the United States, that we had a mutual affinity for baseball. But it turns out that Shankar was a young 17, 18-year-old in San Francisco when his father was the Indian Consul General, and he used to sneak into Candlestick Park to watch the Giants play. And he and I had spent some time at Fenway Park, our cathedral in Boston, recently, and that's been a bond between us as well. But I admire his career. I admire what he has stood for. And I think he has elevated India, along with many of his colleagues on the global stage, and deserves a lot of praise for that. Secondly, it's a really fine book. I read it in manuscript form. It deals with the biggest strategic and most difficult strategic issues that India has had to deal with over the last half century. If you think about the difficult boundaries, we were talking this morning about walls, boundaries, and borders between India and Pakistan, Kashmir, the long dispute with China over that boundary, the wall that separated, more of a metaphorical wall, the United States and India for 40 years. And Shankar was present in resolving, or at least making progress, on many of those. And I think you'll enjoy reading the book, and I think it'll be instructive for a lot of people around the world. A word about the U.S.-India relationship. Strobe was too modest to say that the construction of a big relationship strategically between us has been the product of three administrations. And the administration that had the vision that we should end the cold peace between us and that we should build a strategic relationship was the Bill Clinton administration, and led by Strobe. And the series of conversations that Strobe had with Jaswant Singh in the late 1990s, these weren't conversations that ended all the disputes and misunderstandings, but they explored them, and they created a foundation for this new relationship, particularly with President Clinton's visit, historic visit, I would say, to India in the late 1990s. And then we rarely see this in Washington, in our red-blue dysfunctional environment. But the Clinton administration handed that baton to George W. Bush, and he picked it up and he ran forward with it. And I was lucky enough to participate in some of those events. And then President Obama took the baton from President Bush and has carried it forward. So I Shankar and I agreed this morning, our relationship is as strong now as it's ever been since the creation of the birth of modern India in 1947. And as usual, victory has 1,000 mothers and fathers, and Ambassador Tazi Schaefer, Ambassador Howie Schaefer, Ambassador Robert Einhorn, Ambassador Arun Singh, Deputy Secretary Strobe Talbott are some of the people who built that relationship. So the challenge going forward, when Hillary Clinton is sworn into office on January 20th, 2017, and then creates a relationship, hopefully of trust with Narendra Modi, is how do we carry it forward? And I suppose we both have a lot of ideas for how that can happen. So I'm very happy to be here. Thank you,
Ambassador Burns. I'm actually going to start on that note, and I will take us back and get Ambassador Menon, hopefully, to talk a little bit more about the book, to just give you a little bit of a taste of it. I know you're all going to get it regardless. Is this question, the book is called Choices, and it really is about decision points, the name of President Bush's, the title of President Bush's book. In terms of the U.S.-India relationship, for both of you as you look forward, what are the big choices that lie ahead? Are there certain decision points that you would look for? Is there a next? There's constantly this argument about whether there needs to be a next big thing. What is the big choice that lies ahead for the U.S.-India relationship?
My own sense is that it's not so much a question of finding the next big thing. I think we've done the groundwork, and really it's thanks to people like Strobe, like Nick, that we are where we are. It's bipartisan in India as well, the India-U.S. relationship. And as Nick said, it's better than it's ever been before. I think what we now need to do is actually to build on what we have. And that is across the board, the whole spectrum of the relationship. I find it interesting that when we started the process, which many people in India think is thanks to Hillary Clinton persuading Bill Clinton to visit India, but I don't know whether that's true or not. When we started the relationship, I think the concerns were on the political, strategic side of the relationship. But over time, if you look at it, we have increasing strategic congruence. Wherever you look, in the Asia-Pacific, across on global issues as well, there is increasingly an ability not just to work together, but to actually look at problems similarly. I mean, you saw when President Obama went and visited India, you had a joint vision statement from both countries on security in the Asia-Pacific. We had assumed that there'd be economic complementarity between two very different economies and societies, that the complementarity would drive the relationship. That part is actually getting harder to do than it was anticipated. The politics and the strategy actually have become easier to do than before. Maybe because of the way the world has evolved, what's happened, because of the changing balance of power in Asia, whatever. But the economics of it, I mean, the energy issues, where really you have huge congruence of interest, but you haven't quite converted it into a common approach to climate change, for instance, or on IPRs, on issues like that. I think that's where we really need to apply effort. So if where do we look in the future? I'm much less worried about strategic congruence going forward. In fact, I think that's just going to increase. And a lot of that was started by Nick in those long conversations that we used to have, 4 or 5 hours actually, of just grinding through the issues and talking things through. So we understood what the others, why the other was doing what they were doing. And I'm less worried about that than actually about the social, the economic, the other issues that we need to look at in the relationship. And that's what I would look at as tests of determination on both sides.
Ambassador Burns?
Shankar and I were talking this morning that when people talk about the future of the U.S.-India relationship, the proverbial question always is, what's the next civil nuclear agreement? And I'm not sure we need one. Because as Shankar put it in his introduction, we tore down that wall that had separated the two countries. And so what we need is a normal relationship, and it's happening. Our trade has quadrupled in the last 10 years. We are global partners in a way that we certainly were not 20 years ago. And I think what the Americans in this relationship had to learn is that Indian and American interests are largely aligned, G-N-E-D, in the Indian Ocean and Western Pacific, but we're not going to be allies. And there was this, when I was working with Secretary Condi Rice under her leadership on this relationship, there was always pressure on us from Congress, commentators, that we had to somehow make sure that India didn't deviate from the American line on Iran, for instance, 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it was never going to be the case that this great nation was going to become an ally of the United States. It took the Americans a while to understand that, that our interests may be aligned, but we're separate, we're respectful, we're both great powers in the world. There'll be times when we disagree, and that's normal. I do think our interests are aligned, as Shankar mentioned, in Asia. Both of us have a big relationship with China, trade relationship. We have a partnership with China on climate change, which is very important. And yet neither of us want to see China dominate the Western Pacific or the South China Sea. And to see the expansion of U.S.-India strategic ties, naval and air cooperation, and to see the triangular relationship that's developing between Japan, India, and the United States is, I think, very promising and correct that we should be operating together in this way. So for the future, you do need to have that strategic understanding at the top, and I would credit President Obama with having done a really fine job of relating to Narendra Modi, of deciding where we can work together and where we can't. I do think the relationship is in very good shape. Push forward in Asia together on a peaceful basis, but to assert the strength of the democratic powers, along with Japan and Australia, is going to be very important for us in the future. And I think, last point, the Indian-American community is a real bridge. I know that sounds like a Hallmark card, but it's true. I mean, sometimes in a bilateral relationship, you need some kind of a bridge that physically connects you, and I think the Indian-American community in business, in terms of nonprofit organizations, does that in a very positive way.
In terms of, you mentioned trade, and Ambassador Menon, you talked about how the economic side of the relationship hasn't quite kept up. The U.S. is India's largest trading partner in terms of goods and services, but that growth has, if not stalled, slowed down in terms of the trade. But just in terms of the discussion we've been having here in the course of the campaign and the sentiment about globalization, but also in terms of the U.S.-India relationship, we don't know what's going to happen with TPP. There's not a lot of optimism. But this is not something that India has welcomed, seen it as protectionist. The U.S. has seen India as protectionist and stalling things at the WTO. So where does this go in terms of the political discussion we've been having here? Is that going to be harder to do in the next administration, no matter what it looks like?
Okay.
Well, it's a much tougher global economic environment in which you're both operating. We're no longer in those two decades of open, free trade, investment flows, capital flows, and of open markets, which out of which actually India was maybe the second biggest beneficiary after China of those two decades before 2008. So yes, it will be more difficult because you're in a more difficult environment. Where TPP will go, I don't know. I mean, don't ask me. So to predict how India will react to something that we don't even know what's going to happen, I mean, that's a bit that's too hypothetical for me. But I do think that both sides need to sit and actually talk about this relationship, about market access, about IPRs, about all the trade-related issues, and to see how they carry that forward. A lot of it depends, frankly, on, you know, from an Indian point of view, people look at how does it help to transform India? What does it do for Make in India, for instance, for Indian smart cities, for these big programs that we have going forward to try and change India. And I'd be very nervous of predicting anything until your election's over and the new administration's in place. But I think on the Indian side as well, we need to open up our minds and start thinking about the possibilities and looking at how we take this forward. I think that's very important. What the worst thing possible would be if the Asia-Pacific and the global economy were broken down into little blocks, trading blocks, TPP, RCEP, you know, various little groupings, each of which has its own set of rules, its own external barriers, and excludes everybody else. I mean, that would be the worst possible outcome, and I think we need to work together to avoid that.
I just say two things in response to what Shankar has said, Tanvi. One is our next president is going to have to bind up some of the wounds, and this does relate to our foreign policy that we see from the campaigns, the two primaries and the general election. We have this hateful, divisive language on immigration and refugees from Donald Trump. And we need to rebuild a consensus that we're an immigrant nation and that we should take in refugees and immigrants and not close our doors, number one. Number two, we don't have a consensus on trade from any of the candidates on whether or not we are going to be a free trade, open trade country, Atlantic and Pacific. Number three, the climate of, I think, fear and a loss of self-confidence in our foreign policy that you see by some of the candidates, not Hillary Clinton, but Donald Trump. And so we have some social mending to do to regain our footing and self-confidence so that we can play the role, the leadership role that we clearly have to play in the role in the world. That's the first point. Second, on some of these issues are the issues where we're not doing well in the U.S.-India relationship. I'd say trade and climate. We do not have any kind of meeting of the minds on trade between the United States and India. We were opponents in the Doha round. I'm not a trade negotiator, fortunately, but my colleagues who were, I think, on both sides said some of the worst conversations the U.S. and India have had in the last 10 years have been on trade. And so at some point in the next 10 or 20 years, can we close on our trade relationship? Can we define a common trade future between us? And secondly, I think President Obama was right to engineer his joint venture partnership with Xi Jinping on the Paris Global Climate Change Pact. And it was a key development both in the U.S.-China relationship, but also in that 195-nation pact. India was, I think, in a way, left aside at first and then asked to come in at the last minute. And we're not going to succeed in the next round unless India, China, the United States, Japan, the European Union, the largest economies and carbon emitters, are together from the ground up. So I would think the next administration on trade and climate needs to find a way to build sturdier bridges to India and vice versa, because it's a two-way street.
Just one kind of last question on the U.S.-India side. To each of you, what is the choice that the other country is going to make that concerns you the most?
The next president, I think. That's pretty straightforward.
That's pretty easy. Can we manage our differences? Because even in our relationship with Britain, we have differences, but we have some profound differences with India of outlook, because we're in different places geographically and geopolitically. I think the test of any relationship is not the good days, but can you manage the bad days? And what I think that I really do give credit to Presidents Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, Prime Minister Vajpayee, Prime Minister Manmohan Singh, and now Prime Minister Modi. They've been steady. They haven't let the divisive issues undermine the strength of a growing strategic relationship, which is a very hopeful thing for both of our countries.
And it's there in public opinion, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One thing that sustained us through that negotiation of the 1-2-3 and the whole complicated domestic political process was the fact that we knew that 93% of the public supported it. Maybe not the MPs, but certainly the public was behind it. And today, I mean, they still sell real estate developments in Gurgaon, saying, you know, Palm Beach and Nassau County and so on. And that tells you something about the state of mind. And Pew polls tell you also how popular the U.S. is in India. And so it's not, I think the ground is ripe, is fertile, it's ready. I think a lot of the work has been done to do the hard work that Nick is now saying we need to do on trade, on energy, on climate.
I want to turn to another spur for the relationship that, Ambassador, you mentioned in the book that the governments don't like to talk about, but thankfully once you're out of government, you write about, which is China. And where you see that continuing to play a role, it clearly plays a role in the strategic congruence, in the convergence I think you've called it, and others have, the strategic glue. In terms of China, however, you also talk about in the book, in the context of the U.S.-India nuclear, civil nuclear initiative, and the consequences of that, in terms of the interactive nature of the various relationships, that it did make China make some different choices of its own, particularly vis-a-vis the Pakistanis. But we've also seen this discussion start again about the interactive nature of these relationships and China's role more recently over the last few weeks as Indians have looked at the international community's reaction to the attack against Indian army positions in Kashmir when Russia continued a military exercise with Pakistan. And there was concern that India is getting too close to the U.S. and therefore Russia is moving or at least keeping its options open in terms of both Russia, both Pakistan and China. So in terms of first China and then Russia, and please do comment on this as well, Ambassador Burns, how do you see this kind of China factor playing a role in the future? And is there continuing concern that India is getting too close to the U.S., and what will the consequences be for India's other relationships?
Well, you've heard people say that since, you know, the late 90s, since the whole process of transforming India-U.S. relations began, you've heard some Indians saying you're too close to the U.S. There are others who say you're not close enough. I mean, if you were closer, you wouldn't face a lot of this. My own sense, frankly, is that it's a dynamic balance in the relationships. You mentioned China, you mentioned Russia, Pakistan, whatever. But ultimately, both the U.S. and India have a common interest in having a stable, steady, peaceful relationship with China, a China that's integrated into the region, that performs as a responsible power. Neither of us wants to see our relationship with China deteriorate or get much worse because of what we are doing. And I don't think anything we do actually should cause concern on the Chinese side. The Chinese are more than willing to do exactly that, or if not more, with the U.S. themselves. But that's the way states behave. The fact that there is commentary in India, I think, is normal. We have a very broad bandwidth of criticism for any policy in India, and it's part of the democratic way of making foreign policy. The difference, I think, in India, and this is an internal Indian issue, is that foreign policy has become a domestic political consideration to a much greater extent than it used to be, say, when we started the process of transforming India-U.S. relations. So you'll hear many more comments like this, saying, oh, it's because of your relationship with the U.S. that things are going wrong, or that you haven't done enough for this relationship. And people are much more involved in this, and you'll see much more commentary. But I don't think that changes the basic thrust of Indian policy, nor does it change the fact that, frankly, just as China has a relationship with the U.S., so does India. The U.S. has a relationship with both, and none of us actually want this to deteriorate. So I'm actually fairly hopeful that we can actually kick all these relationships up to a better level to where we can work better together. There will be tactical consequences of individual choices. I mean, you mentioned civil nuclear, and I think you saw the reaction immediately with China selling nuclear plants to Pakistan. And you can see some of it in the way the NSG is now playing out, the NSG membership. But those are tactical. But as long as that basic strategic goal, and as long as what I'm saying is right about what all three seek out of this, then I think we're okay. I think the tactical parts can be managed. I mean, that's what diplomats are for.
So, Shankar is a true China expert. He's one of India's great China experts. Maybe the next book, or a book or two away, is Shankar's chronicling of his family's involvement, his grandfather, his father, himself, over a very long time in India's relationship with China. I think we have some different similarities and differences. The similarity is that both of us, both India and the United States, have to see China as a partner in some respects. We've talked about climate, counterterrorism. The three of us, because of our weight in the world, are going to have to be working together on some of the big transnational issues for our own futures and the futures of other countries. So what we haven't done yet is even really tried to pool the resources of the three countries together in a big initiative. And that would be an interesting thought process. Where and how could we do that in the next 10 years? But the reality is, and I'll just speak as an American, I don't want to speak for Shankar, is that we're also competitors with China for military power in Asia. And that for the Americans and Chinese, for the Americans to balance partnership and competition with a big country like China, I think will be the most difficult foreign policy challenge for the next half century for our kids, our grandchildren, and for us as well. And I think it's probably similar with India, but not identical, because India is a lot closer. There's a border conflict. There was a war not too long ago in the 1960s. And so similarities and differences in this. But wouldn't it be interesting to see these three countries take on a project together? It might build some trust and confidence.
Delhi has watched that balance since India got independent, looked, and particularly since 1949, has looked at that balance that the U.S. has tried to make between the competitive and the cooperative side with China. And there are concerns about the nature of that balance, potentially what in short form is called the G2. Do those concerns still exist? And also in terms of this, as India looks out, or as you, given your experience, look out, what most concerns you as you look at China's rise?
Well, I think with China, we've for a long time now had a relationship which is, as Nick says, has elements of cooperation and competition at the same time. And that's one of the hardest things to pull off, actually, to manage a relationship like that. I don't think we did a very good job of it in the late 50s, early 60s. But we did manage in the early 80s to find between India and China a modus vivendi, basically, which was we'd discuss the difficult things, but we wouldn't let that get in the way of building the rest of the relationship, trade and so on. And we would cooperate where we could, even on global issues, on other regional issues. But I think that modus vivendi maybe is no longer valid. I mean, that's what I think all these little signs of trouble that we see in the relationship of stress. And I think it's time that we actually worked a new modus vivendi out between India and China. So for me, that's the worrying part, that unless we do that and do that successfully through a strategic dialogue which actually talks through the various issues. But the balance itself is a much bigger balance than just the US and China and how it affects, or just US, China, India, because Russia has always been a part of that. Japan has always been a part of that. And none of these are identical. They might be allies with the U.S. or with somebody else, or they might be partners. But none of this balance has constantly shifted to attain equilibrium right through this period. And, I mean, if you look at it from the end of the Vietnam War itself, you've had a series of balances. And it has so far managed to keep the peace. I mean, you know, why are we worried now about Asia-Pacific? Because we see the world's greatest arms buildup. We see a sudden change in the balance of power with China's rise and the rise of other powers at the same time. So we're not quite sure whether this equilibrium will come back or not, whether we can do it. So, and we share a periphery with this China. Our periphery is their periphery as well. So we rub up against each other in this periphery, whether it's the Indian Ocean, South China Sea, and on land as well. So that, I think, is part of the problem. I think this is where it doesn't matter whether it's India, whether it's China, whether it's Japan. We look to the U.S. and the next U.S. administration to see how the U.S. is going to react to this. I think that's where the U.S. role becomes critical, because the traditional security architecture, the hub and spokes, U.S. extended deterrence to allies, worked so far. Will it work in the new balance of power? I don't know. People are nervous. If they weren't nervous, they wouldn't be arming themselves the way they are throughout the Asia-Pacific. So I think that's what the new administration really should address right away. Its commitment to Asia-Pacific, to the security, and to actually building out an architecture together with the Asian powers that can keep the peace, which has enabled Asia to become prosperous, actually, which has made the rise of China and all that we've seen in Asia, the economic strength that you now see, made that possible.
You mentioned stresses in the China-India relationship, but China's relations with a number of countries that we've seen recently. But in the context of the China-India relationship, one of the perhaps more visible stresses over the last few months has been over India's desire to join the nuclear suppliers group. The book actually talks about the waiver that India received in 2008. There've been a lot of comparisons made to that time, and one of the things that it'd be interesting, I'm sure you'll be asked about this a lot, particularly when you do the book launch in Delhi, but what are the differences that you see, particularly in international context, that people haven't really seen or pointed out, or the similarities for that matter?
Well, I think the big difference is we sought an individual exception for ourselves in 2008. Now we're seeking membership, which is a much broader and potentially has application to other countries and so on. So the countries who have to decide on it differently. I would love to say that we got 2008 because of our brilliance and how well Nick and his successor, Bill Burns, and all of us worked together to get it done. I think that's partly true, but it's not the full explanation. But luckily, you know, history doesn't repeat itself. I mean, today you're in a very different situation in the NSG. My own sense is that, frankly, India can today has the exemption, can cooperate with any NSG member who's willing to cooperate with her, can do what it needs to. So, frankly, the membership, I'm not sure that it's actually as necessary today as the exemption was in 2008. I think it's a very different category of issue today.
There's also in the book for those of you those of you who are interested a chapter on the 1993 Border Peace and Tranquility Agreement with China, one of those times where the cooperative side did come out, and was going to ask you about what the prospects of a border settlement, boundary settlement are now, but I actually wonder, and I want to get to Q&A, but I also want to get to and a couple of other questions, particularly given what's been going on in South Asia in the last few weeks. You mentioned in your chapter on the Mumbai attacks called Restraint or Riposte, you say at the end of that chapter, the aftermath of the Mumbai attack also revealed the limits of diplomacy. And then you say, if India is forced to make a similar choice in the future, I am sure it will respond differently. And we've seen the Modi government's reaction in the last few weeks after the attack on the military positions that I mentioned in Kashmir. What do you make of the choices that he has made? And would this have been, as we look ahead, particularly this was in Kashmir, it was against military positions. What are the things that the government will consider, the policymakers, what choice will they make? Had this been an attack been in another part of the country, potentially in Delhi, Mumbai, but also with large number of civilian casualties?
Well, I think the choices that this government made now in responding to Uri and how it did it, I think they were very clever choices, they were good choices, and they were correct, and I'm glad they bore out my prophecy in the book. But it's the reason I said that was actually because if there was going to be a similar kind of attack, it obviously meant that deterrence had failed, that restraint and the deterrence that it produced, whether in terms of international pressure, diplomatic isolation, in terms of also whatever India might have done covertly in the meantime, that all that had stopped deterring further such attacks. So the government would have to consider a different response thereafter. And that's really the logic. That's why I made that prediction. And I think what they've done now stays within the boundaries of strategic restraint, because it's ultimately, from an Indian point of view, this is on Indian territory against terrorists, preemptive, against their launch pads before they were about to hit India again. So it stays within the overall framework of strategic restraint. But it also does change the calculus. certainly, for the terrorists and their sponsors. And that part, I'm not sure. I really don't know. I'm not party to government's thinking or how it thinks these issues through. So I don't want to speculate on what would happen if it were a mass casualty terrorist attack somewhere else in India with very large numbers of civilian casualties. But I think that would be very risky for anybody to try and do that. I think there is a risk there.
Last month, many American governments have had to deal with India-Pakistan crises. And we've seen in the last few weeks that the White House, on the day that India took action across the LOC, make a pretty strong statement of support. But what are some of the, and you've been in an administration, Strobe was in an administration that with Cargill, that has seen as contributing, and you've seen the last three administrations, contributing to what people call de-hyphenation of the relationship. A number of people wonder if that will return at some point. Is that something that you foresee happening? That is the U.S. Re-hyphenating between India and Pakistan.
I think it would be a great mistake if we attempted to frame our relations with these two countries as some kind of, you know, we have to have equal treatment and equal levels of interest, because we have an entirely different relationship with India, much more positive, much more engaged, much more integrated than we do with Pakistan. And when Shankar was talking about Kashmir, I was thinking back to the strategic situation that Strobe dealt with as deputy secretary was entirely different. We had a closer relationship with Pakistan. We had a higher degree of mutual interest with Pakistan. President Clinton and Strobe were able to play a role of diffusing a crisis, the cargo crisis, because of the influence we had in Islamabad. I don't think President Obama has that degree of influence now. The U.S.-Pakistan relationship has clearly suffered because of our lack of confidence in Pakistan over its inability to fight terrorist groups on its own soil that have led to the deaths of Americans in Afghanistan, our soldiers in Afghanistan. And you've just seen this big swing in America's confidence and trust in Delhi and a decline in our confidence and trust in Islamabad. So I don't think President Obama can position himself, nor do I think that Delhi especially would want him to, as some kind of even-handed mediator. And I do think that Condi Rice was absolutely right in March 2005 when she first went to India's Secretary of State and she said, it does not make strategic sense to the United States to have some kind of equal strategic interest in these two countries when clearly our relationship with India is rising, and I would never want to see us to go back. But Strobe might want to comment on this, and certainly Tazi and Howie. Ambassador Singh, there are a lot of people here who have more experience on the Pakistani side than I do.
I'm going to, one final question for me, for both of you, and then we'll turn to audience Q&A, which is this, you both served in different administrations, across different administrations. This subject of continuity and change in Indian foreign policy, the book suggests, as you call it, bold steps, bold decisions, but then cautious implementation in terms of the tactical steps. But actually talks about some of these moments of change. But you also talk a lot about the continuity in Indian foreign policy over time. What do both of you see in the last 2 years? Are there changes you see in the Modi government's approach to the world, but also to the U.S. that you would identify that moves away from some of the continuity?
After you.
When Prime Minister Modi took office, I think a lot of us didn't quite know how he was going to approach the United States because of the fact that we had denied him a visa when he was chief minister in Gujarat. And yet, how often do we think about that issue now? It's completely disappeared. And I've not been part of the Modi-U.S. relationship. I've been out of government, but I've been struck by the singularity of purpose in Prime Minister Modi in elevating the U.S.-India strategic relationship. And as I said before, you know, I think all of us, and a lot of us, have lived the red-blue divide in Washington, where the two parties don't agree on a lot of issues, but that the exception is India, where the authorship of the strategic relationship is both Republican and Democratic, and it's BJP in Congress. So I expect our next president, no matter who it is, to be able to ride that wave forward and expect that both political parties in the United States will support a big relationship with India. And Modi has been very clear that he wants a deeper relationship. I think he's been most clear of all the last three or four Indian prime ministers about what he wants to achieve with the U.S.
Last amendment.
In terms of continuity, I actually see a great deal of continuity. Quite apart from election rhetoric and so on and political attacks across the aisle, as Nick said, there is actually bipartisan consensus on most of the issues. If you look at what the Modi government has done, say the Bangladesh land boundary agreement, you know, what it did with other neighbors, what it tried to do with Pakistan as well, actually there is continuity with, but there is also evolution. And I would say the relationship with the U.S. is an instance of learning, of evolving, and of trying to build on what there was before and to kick it to a whole new level. I mean, he really has invested very heavily in that relationship and brought it up to a level which I think is much higher than it ever was before. So there's been evolution, but most of this is logical evolution from the past. So for me, therefore, I would stress the continuity. I find that very reassuring, actually, because it suggests that it's Indian policy. So it'll stay. It'll last. Also, it reflects Indian interests. If it didn't, it wouldn't be Indian policy. And so for me, actually, this is better. It also guarantees it'll stay bipartisan as we go forward. And for me, that's important, because it's very difficult to run a successful policy if it's very fractious at home and very divisive at home. And if I actually think the evolution has been good. That doesn't mean that, you know, this government doesn't face new issues which weren't faced before, and that's where they have to innovate. In some senses, it's a strange thing to say. I used to keep saying, oh, where's this government's vision? It's actually good they don't have one, because they can react pragmatically to what they see, and they can do the things that they need to do in foreign policy, at least. I mean, this is so I actually find that refreshing, this pragmatism which we've seen. So that's my answer to continuity or change, pragmatism, and more continuity than I'd have expected.
And, of course, it also means that the one difference is we all have to be on Twitter if we follow Indian foreign policy. And I would also point out that Ambassador Menon has recently joined
yesterday.
Twitter.
Yesterday.
I'm following you.
So I have no idea how this works. So please don't expect anything from me on Twitter. But I'll learn.
You can follow him at Menon49.
Menon's foot.
We will tweet about that later. But I'll turn now to audience question and answers. Please identify yourself, and if you could keep your question or comment short, that would be appreciated. Questions. We'll start here, and then there. We'll take a couple of questions.
I'm Michael Yehuda from GW. In the past, when people talked about Indian foreign policy, especially Indians, there would always be some mention of non-alignment. Today, none of you mentioned that. So is that, can we assume that that is something that just belongs to the past and just maybe is repeated perhaps out of ritualistic purposes, or does it still have any force in terms of India's sense of itself in relation to the outside world as a whole?
I think the problem is, who is there left to align with? And I think the word you hear now is strategic autonomy as a sort of goal of policy. For me, it means the same as non-alignment did. But clearly, that's not how it's heard outside. I think the rest of the world treats non-alignment as somehow a Cold War construct and within, and it has a certain meaning. It seems to have a whole set of connotations that come along with it for the rest of the world, which is why I think in the U.S. I find that non-alignment borders on the derogatory in the way most people speak of it. But for me, it's the same thing as strategic autonomy, and that, I think, will remain an Indian goal. partly because of the sense that India is unique in many ways, in its position, in the nature of its society, its economy, in what it needs from the international order. So there is a very strong streak of Indian exceptionalism, which I think the only other country who can match us is the US, maybe, in this. And therefore, I think that strategic autonomy as a goal will remain, no matter who is in power and across the political spectrum.
Just my quick addition, I agree with everything Shankh, he's the authority on this question, is I think what we've had to learn, I don't know if I explained this properly before, is that Americans are used to dealing with allies, and we're the most powerful in the equation. U.S. Japan, U.S. Germany, U.S. Australia, U.S. U.K. And it was a learning experience for us to develop this strategic relationship with India, because India is equal. It's not a junior ally of the United States. And I think I never felt this way, but I felt the pressure in the Bush administration, particularly from Congress, as I said, that whenever India asserted itself in a different way, we got a call. What's happening? Why are you close to India when they're not agreeing with you?
I'm so glad they rang him, not me.
And this is a very different relationship that we're constructing than an alliance relationship. And it's equally valuable in strategic terms between us. So that's what we've had to learn. I think we've learned that lesson in the last decade.
We'll take a couple of questions together. There are two here, and then after that we'll move to this side.
Good morning, Seamus Weitzel. I'm a student at GW, and I did buy your book, sir. So India is an incredibly diverse country ethnically, culturally, and it has, in certain areas along its border, there's old ethnic and cultural connections across international borders as opposed to within them. And so in what way does that diversity impact India's foreign policy decision making? Thanks.
Well, I think across most of our borders, what you say is true. Mizos on our side are Chins in Myanmar, Tamils, Sri Lanka, every border, and Bangladesh, of course. So it's the approach that the last government took was to say that to the extent we can, we need to make borders irrelevant. That used to be something that Manmohan Singh used to speak of very often. Because the lines are artificial, as you said. They cut across ethnic. They cut across the fact that this used to be one big market economically for most of history. And so but changing boundaries affects people's, you know, state sovereignty, the idea of that's a very difficult thing to do and is much more complicated. So the attempt was constantly to try and make them irrelevant to people's daily lives. Make travel easier, make trade easier, make tourism, whatever. Make it possible for people not to worry about these and to build the connectivity across these boundaries. We still have a very long way to go to achieve that kind of state. Partly because the politics, there are strong domestic political reasons in most countries to maintain these. I mean, the idea of walls is attractive, unfortunately. In most societies, there is a small segment who, and it becomes a sovereignty issue. So those are hard to do. But that's really the way I would rather think about it, is how do we make them irrelevant? Because this can be a huge source of strength in terms of pacifying the periphery, in terms of relationships across these lines. It could be a great sense source of strength. Right now, it's 50-50. It works for and against your goal of a peaceful periphery.
And the chapter in the book on Sri Lanka actually covers some of the ethnic similarities plays into domestic politics and then foreign policy. We'll take the question back there and then Tezi over here.
I'm Prakash Ambegaonkar from Bridging Nations Foundation. And for a long time, we have been working towards this U.S., India, China, what we call power triangle, prosperity triangle. And there is quite a bit of many times what I find people say, real interest of United States and India is to really make India as a hedge against China. Leaving that aside, I would like to ask Ambassador Menon, in terms of the Security Council admission for India, that has been talked about and is a ticklish point for a long time. Do you see, since you know China so much, that it is possible that China might change that position and allow India to be a permanent member of Security Council? Or do you think India needs to do something? Because the U.S. has already supported the perspective after a long time, but when President Obama visited India last time, and I think I forget the year, he has supported. So the only person holding back to get India in the Security Council is China. So can you tell us something about it?
Well, I can't speak for the Chinese. And I don't know whether the Chinese are going to change their mind or not. You know, you need a moment when, what is it, 128 members
votes.
Of the General Assembly, all five permanent members of the Council, all together at the same time agree that India should be a permanent member. Those conditions don't exist. And it's more than just China, actually, if you look at it. When those conditions will exist, I really don't know. I'm only a former diplomat, not an astrologer.
Nick, do you have anything on that?
I think the reality is that China's been blocking India, both in New York on the nuclear suppliers group question. China's been blocking Japan. China doesn't want to see an expansion of these World War II era international institutions to look like the 21st century. Chinese are going to have to accommodate themselves because at some point the pressure is going to be too much. We will get in the variable geometry to 128 votes, but it'll be a big expansion. Because you need an African country, you need Brazil or Mexico, you certainly need Japan, as well as India. And we've not been able to figure this out in 30 years. It's all about geometry, political geometry. But China is, you can be sure, not in favor of what the U.S., President Obama, wants with India on the Security Council.
Question over here, Tazie.
Tazie Schaefer, and I am part of the expanded Brookings home team, and it's lovely to see you, Shankar. First of all, I must thank our distinguished visitor for having given my husband and me quite a lot of time when we were working on the book we published earlier this year, and we're eager to read his book. But I wonder if you would be willing to expand a bit on a subject that has been touched on, but only very briefly, namely, India's economic footprint in the world. What do you see as the what do you see and what do you think the current government sees as the strategic importance of trade negotiations? This is an issue that the United States is painfully wrestling with, and India is doing some of the same wrestling. But how important is this for India's broader strategic impact on the world? Is there a choice that needs to be made about taking another bet on globalization, which was successful the last time, or is this an area where India can basically avoid that choice and avoid the difficult political consequences it faces? And how much does it matter?
Well, I think there's no question that there's a very strong strategic argument to be made in India for a much more open, outgoing trade policy than perhaps we've had before. But this is a very hard argument to make domestically. You see the same thing in the U.S. It's very hard to argue in Congress or in Parliament that, look, you need to do this for strategic reasons. You need to open up your market. You need to do whatever, raise standards, raise levels. But you're asking somebody who's completely ignorant about this. And since we're talking home team, we have really the expert on this sitting in the audience, Harshvardhan, from Brookings India, who runs Brookings India, used to be in WTO, used to be the deputy head. So really, I think we should ask him to answer this. Will you?
No. Do you want to? Or we could leave it for an entirely different event, but please.
Both are possible. But very quickly, I always feel that when one looks at globalization or multilateralization, one forgets that it involves more than one party whenever one is looking at it. Therefore, you define multilateralization in terms of the way you will want it to be. And the way it will go forward is when each side recognizes the interest of the other and moves in such a way that there is a landing zone. It's not as if India is not in favor of multilateralization. In fact, India realizes the strategic importance of a global system, as does the United States. But the reality of the situation is that politics in the United States, much more than the politics in India, actually comes up with demands which are very difficult to multilateralize. And in that context, the only way you can move in multilateralization is by not looking at a large set of issues, but issues where you can actually have a landing zone. So within the WTO, you have got something on agriculture export subsidies. There is e-commerce being worked on. There are efforts through different kind of negotiations on IT. India is not a part of it. Why India is seen as not being an active part of it is also because the domestic industry does not feel strong enough to face competition in a major way. And India is making efforts to remedy that. It wants to acquire technology. It wants to facilitate doing business. Instead of the border measures, it is taking the... Because trade policy is also inside the border. And India is actually very open and facilitating on the inside the border trade policies, maybe not as much as some of the others outside might want it. So when you take a look at it, it's a process where hopefully it will lead to situations where multilateralization will take place more and more, and it doesn't serve India's strategic interests at all to be out of bilateral agreements. But I think at present, it's part of domestic policy, and domestic industry does not feel comfortable with opening the market in a big way. So that needs to be prepared in a transitional manner, and only when people understand that will the multilateralization take place.
We're going to take a group of questions so that we can get a few more in. We'll take the three over here in the room.
Thank you very much, Madan. I am Dr. Nisar Chaudhary with Pakistan American League. My question is, Ambassador Byrne. He mentioned about China and then triangle and then security pact with so many countries extending even up to Australia. How do you think China perceives it and takes it? Chinese think it's not a triangle, it's a Bermuda Triangle for them. So how do you help them to overcome that kind of skepticism when you have so many friends and allies all around China? What friends and allies China has in this region? And for Ambassador Menon, India is not a country, it's a continent and is emerging as a global player and a global power player. And that is fine. But don't you think it will be much easier for India to become global player and a power player after reconciling with all its neighbors? And Tanvi, you mentioned about Russia, Pakistan. Just a half second.
Can we, please, we've got a lot of questions. Maybe we can take that up when we can discuss it later. Thank you. Charlie, did you have a question?
Yes.
Right here, and then we'll go back there.
Thank you, Tanvi. Charlie Ebinger, Brookings. Ambassador, I wondered if you might comment on what you see as the relations between Delhi and Kathmandu. As you know, there are at least a number of political parties in Nepal that are constantly skeptical about what India's motivations are, even when you do wonderful things like help them after the earthquake and so forth.
And then we'll take that one there. Right.
Thank you very much. My question was also on Nepal, so I'm going to add to that. To Ambassador Menon, there's fear among Nepalese these days that India will impose some kind of economic embargo on Nepal because the constitution amending process is not exactly moving towards the direction that some restive groups in the southern Terai belt would like to see. And apart from the political rhetoric, our inept leadership has not been able to diversify Nepal's dependence on India. So, and as we have experienced, something like economic blockade will affect the ordinary citizens the most, not those few who are in power. So people are really